Blog Talk Radio.
Because we're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers number one. Yes, we're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers number one.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to Ballard Radio. My name is Matt Weston, and tonight I'm joined by, or am supposed to be joined by, the biggest, fattest, strongest one of all time. I'm still waiting for him right now. He hasn't called in just yet. I'm sure he's, you know, finding his way to the bottom of the bottle, or eating a lot, or taking human growth hormone. But in the meantime, for tonight's show, we're going to talk about the Lions game, Andre Johnson, and kind of look at the playoff picture entering the bye week. So without further ado, hey, BFD, how's it going?
Hello. Hello, everybody. Miss me?
We missed your song, though, is what you missed.
No, can y'all hear me when I'm singing like that? That's awesome.
I think so. Yeah, I go back and listen to it occasionally, and we can hear you singing. If you want, we can just start all over again, and then that way I can just edit out the very beginning and kind of run it clean everybody who's listening.
No, let's move forward.
All right, well, BFD, did you know that Andre Johnson is the greatest Texan of all time?
I would have to say so. I mean, I think that at this point, J.J. Watt was catching up pretty quickly with him. But as far as the credentials and the number of seasons and those sorts of things, he was a joy to watch and a great guy to root for. And I would have to agree with your assessment that, yes, he is the greatest Texan of all time.
Yeah, I mean, I guess J.J. Watt is definitely the best Texan of all time. But just far as, like, when he came to this team, him being, like, the first really great player in the franchise history, we'll get some more about, like, the quarterbacks he played with and all that a little bit, too. But I just think, like, overall, it's kind of that thing I always talk about, like, there's a big difference between what the best movie you've ever seen is and what your favorite movie is. So, like, somebody's favorite movie may be Face Off, but the best movie they've ever seen, you know, may be The Shining. It just kind of depends. There's two different things, obviously, there. But we're going to get to the game in a little bit, but I just really don't want to talk about it. It was, you know, we watched the game together, and it was just so boring. Like, I think we talked about the actual game probably like 20 minutes of the 3 hours we hung out and watched it. And, I'd rather just spend 4 hours talking about Andre Johnson instead than talk about this game for 25 minutes.
Yeah, it's really hard to disagree with that sentiment. It was a really a painful game. It really was. It was a very painful game to watch. And, you know, we joked about it as it was going through that, you know, we're watching Alfred Blue carry this football, and we're watching a defense that's without J.J. Watt and can't win one-on-one matchups to get to the quarterback. And it's like, you know, the most exciting thing is Tyler Irvin returning a kick, because you just don't know what kind of craziness is going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, that game reminded me kind of, like, sometimes I'll go out in the real world, try to buy, like, pants or clothes, and I just go, like, five different stores, and none of them have my length, and I just wasted, like, 3 hours and didn't get anything out of it, and just go home just kind of sad and upset. And that's pretty much what this game was like for me. But when it comes to Andre Johnson, like, emotionally, are you all right? You know, did your eyes get misty at all? Did you drink, you know, 20 beers last night and watch Andre Johnson highlight videos and just cry, console yourself?
I drank 20 beers last night, but not because of Andre Johnson. It was Halloween, dang it. And I didn't really drink 20 beers. I think I'd be pretty dead at that point. I think, you know, the answer is yes. I'm kind of a sentimental dude anyway. And so for like, one of my all-time favorite football players to retire, it's a sad moment, just like it was when Arian retired. And it's, I had this sad.
Yeah, I got a little misty-eyed last night watching some highlight videos and, you know, writing about him and, you know, writing my obituary for him. And but I think also, like, as I've grown up, I've gotten a lot more sensitive and a lot more emotional. Like, I was watching, I think, like, the last episode of Bob's Burgers on Netflix, and it made me cry, and I felt so stupid, and I felt so silly. And it's just kind of like what's happened, I guess, as you get older, where you have a lot more life experiences, a lot more things that you can connect to, a lot more things to make you feel certain things. And this is kind of like no different Andre Johnson, where, you know, I grew up watching him. I know like Tim wrote about how he watched him for a third of his life, and I watched him since I was 12. I don't remember a lot of his plays, and it'd be a lot different to be, you know, somebody his age who can remember him from a rookie, watching him play all this time, and watching, you know, Texans be really bad, and watch and just see him kind of like mature in the situation, all that, and him being like the only good thing to come out of watching the Texans play on Sunday.
Yeah, and that was really the case in some of those years when we were fielding some pretty poor teams. And you're just, you know, again, we're talking about the excitement factor, because even, you know, David Carr and Sage Rosenfeld and Matt Schaub could get the ball to Andre Johnson. And that was exciting, because when he was doing his thing, I mean, there are so many memorable catches. There's a catch against Miami at home that led to the Schaub plan QB draw. You know, the catch that he made on the fourth down and 17, the catch that he made against the Redskins in the end zone, the Muhammad Ali catch. My favorite was always the ping pong catch against the Arizona Cardinals. Three guys tried to take him down, and he destroyed all three. All of them with big hits, too. He was just a blast to watch. Just truly a blessing to be able to watch him Sunday after Sunday for so many years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my favorite play of his was that Washington Redskins Hail Mary play, because I think they tied it to put into overtime. Texas ended up winning in overtime. And that was also the 2010 season. And 2009 was such a bad year where they were really close, and they ended up blowing a bunch of those close games. That was the year that Mark Sanchez, at his very first game, you know, beat Houston week one. And, you know, the spot of talent was kind of the same as Texas that year. Yeah, and then that 2010 year, they start off 2-0. And I was stupid, and I was like, yeah, we're going to make the playoffs this year. And then, of course, they end up losing dumb games like the Arizona game, I think, was that same year. There was just so many one-possession losses that year. And it was kind of the same thing until the following season, where, like, things finally clicked and came together. But, yeah, that Hail Mary catch that he caught, we're just like, he jumps right over the safety. He takes it, and the safety just falls down in agony, and he spikes into the ground, and they end up winning it overtime. Was awesome. That was also a Redskins team that had Donovan McNabb, too.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot about that. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So in Andrew Johnson's career, he caught passes from David Carr, Tony Banks, Dave Ragone, Sage Rosenfels, Matt Schaub, T.J. Yates, Jake Delhomme, Case Keenum, Ryan Fitzpatrick, Ryan Mallett, Matt Hasselbeck, Andrew Luck, Charlie Whitehurst, Ryan Lilly, Josh Freeman, and Marcus Mariota. When you think of all these like Hall of Fame wide receivers out there, can you name one that has been dealt such a terrible hand when it comes to the quarterbacks they're playing with?
I'd have to think about it a little bit more, but it's a great question, because how about
I read them off again and you think about it? Because I really like reading all these names off, okay?
You either want to cry or punch a wall. It's one of the two.
Yeah, he caught passes from David Carr, Tony Banks, Dave Ragone, Sage Rosenfels, Matt Schaub, T.J. Yates, Jake Delhomme, Case Keenum, Ryan Fitzpatrick, Ryan Mallett, Matt Hasselbeck, Andrew Luck, Charlie Whitehurst, Ryan Lindley, Josh Freeman, and Marcus Mariota. And in the game, Rex Grossman was 0 for 6. He was able to complete a pass to him. I just really just like, it's such a funny just batch of names there.
I'm having a hard time. I mean, you can think about some guys, like I was thinking Art Moss went through a series of poor quarterbacks, but at least he had Doug Williams before time. You know, at least Andre had Matt Schaub, a pro bowler, but that's a really crummy list. I mean, that's really dealing from the bottom of the deck.
Yeah, I mean, I can't name anybody off the top of my head, you know, really at all. I mean, if you look at some of the wide receivers right now that are going to go to the Hall of Fame, you know, Fitzgerald had some rough times, but then he had some peak years. He had some, you know, great later on years from Kurt Warner, same thing from Carson Palmer. So like, he had the majority of the time it was bad, but he had some, like, you know, he had 4 or 5 years of, like, not above average Pro Bowl quarterbacks, but like MVP type quarterbacks. And I think that's kind of the difference between those two. But that's the best comparison I can think of.
Wow.
Yeah.
Poor Andre. No wonder Andre hit the road after 2014. Got so pissed at Schaub, and just no wonder. I mean, that's just terrible. Nobody should have to deal with that sort of thing.
Yeah, in that 13 season, he was really good that year. I mean, he was really pretty good that year, too. Like, he had that game against Indianapolis where he had, like, 200 yards receiving the first half from Case Keenum that they ended up losing the second half. But they lost 14 games in a row, and that Oakland game just stands out, as you mentioned, where Matt Schaub doesn't throw it into the end zone. But they lose the Matt McGloin-led Oakland Raiders, and it was like watching Mommy and Daddy find the sideline. Like, it was really bad. And Andre Johnson kind of runs off and goes to the tunnel and left. And that was one of the things, too. Like, there's, like, two things about being a Texas fan that I really find disgusting. One was the people who, like, hung out Matt Schaub's house during the pick six streak. I would say that's not the majority of fans. It's just, like, two or three people just being a bunch of idiots. But in addition to that, like, all the jersey burning that occurred, and just not revisionist history that goes around with Schaub to say, oh, he was terrible the entire time, which isn't true. Matt Schaub was above average, you know, Pro Bowl caliber quarterback for, you know, four or five of those years. And he just kind of, when he fell off hard. And the other thing, too, the other part was Andre Johnson leaving in 14. Yeah, that was not anything to hold against Andre Johnson. He was told he was going to get 40 catches. They signed in Washington to replace him. He left. He got cut. He wanted to go to a team where he thought he had a chance to win a ring, so he chose Indy. He wanted to play for the Indians quarterback, chose Andrew Luck. And it didn't work out probably because, one, he fell off really fast in 2018. Kind of really fucking really fast for this year. And two, like, the coach was really bad as well. But even if he finally had a chance to see the situation, it still didn't work out. And so, like, he really never caught a break when it came to, like, the team and what he couldn't control.
Yeah. Just think if he would have had a healthy – I mean, just think if Ryan Grigson was a competent, you know, GM, that would have been helpful for him. But, you know, the dude played for guys like, you know, Rick Smith, who everybody should know by now is not a favorite of mine, and then, you know, the incredibly inept and incompetent Charlie Casserly. That's who Andre Johnson got to play for, is cats like that. So that must have been just – but those quarterbacks and those GMs, that must have been terrible.
Yeah.
So,
and, I mean, I guess that's
have your days for him.
Yeah, and even if they had talent, too, it just took so long for that to click, you know, because it was like, what, like 09, 10. Well, I guess it really wasn't that one, but it was like it was 2 years it took for those teams to click, and then when they did, they clicked real well in 11, the first half of 12, and then Schaub kind of really fell off in that second half. But, yeah, and I guess, like, the best way to describe Andre Johnson's career is, like, what I wrote about, where it's like a career filled with brilliance, and, like, he ran a 4.4 40. He's 6'3", 220, and ran a 4.4 coming out of Miami. And he's just such a physically gifted player, and he was such a great route runner. And I also think one of the most underrated aspects of this game was how good he was at finding holes in zone coverage. I mean, him and Schaub ran some play action, like 12-yard ins, where he just found in the middle of the zone and just sat there, you know, wide open. But his thing is just a career mark of frustration. And I think kind of the part that goes to, like, he's not going to be remembered for any of his plays, really, or any of his games. I don't think he's going to be remembered for beating Cortland Finnegan, which is, like, the ultimate just, like, culmination of – you know, that kind of season there, 5-5, all the years of having to deal with him, and just all of it coming out at once. And so I just think it was like the perfect encapsulation of, like, his entire career right there.
So is there any doubt, does anybody out there doubt that he gets into the Hall of Fame? I'd be curious to know. I mean, he put up some good counting stats. He was always the top one or number two wide receiver in the league. So what's going to be cool is in 5 years, he's going to have a jersey hanging in Canton. And I think that'll be pretty cool.
Yeah.
And it'll be a Texas jersey.
Mm-hmm. That'd be funny if he goes in there with a Titans jersey, something like that. but that would be a good way to stick it to, you know, those quarterbacks we talked about earlier. But, yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a question that he doesn't get in the Hall of Fame. I think part of it is he's top 10 in catches and yards. And you look at the quarterbacks he's had. But even if he was, like, you know, top 15, I still think he would, just because he was the first great player in the history of this franchise. I think that will count for something to the voters, where there still hasn't been a Texan in yet. If they don't put Andre Johnson in, then it's not going to be another 10 years until J.J. Watt does. So I think that will kind of have a big part of that as well, too, when it comes to the voting process.
I hope so. I do hope so.
Yeah. And so I talk about the frustration, and Are you kind of worried that something similar is going to happen to J.J. Watt when it comes to, you know, the team performance? I think the difference with Watt, though, is that he's had those, like, really incredible years where he was no doubt the best player. He's had just some, like, remarkable – you still can't even get over price as well. But when it comes to the actual team, he's going to be 28 next year. He's coming back from back surgery. He already had what maybe his peak, those, you know, three defensive player of the year seasons and even 14 where he probably would have won except for, you know, the whole 14 games losing in a row. Or, yeah, I should say 13. And he's also playing for a team that hitched his wagon, Brock Osweiler, who they're going to have for a year and a half. And if that doesn't work out, they have to find another quarterback on top of that. So are you worried that we're going to be saying this, having the same conversation, you know, in 7 years whenever it comes to J.J. Watt?
I really am. You know, nothing's changed in the fact that I'm still not a big fan of Rick Metz. And this Brock Osweiler thing is turning out to be a complete disaster. So I think you're looking at the Texans. You know, I still think we make the playoffs this year just because of the dumpster fire of a division that we're in. But, you know, we're not going to go anywhere. So this is going to be a team that, you know, gets close to the playoffs, makes the playoffs, that gets, you know, whipped in the first round. And that just seems like a thing that's going to happen, and which sucks. That really sucks if you're J.J. Watt. And I can't imagine he's at all happy about that scenario. Because is he ever going to sniff a trophy? Is he ever going to sniff a conference championship game? And I don't know, but, you know, chances are he's starting to hit that 30-year mark, and that's a big deal when you're a football player. It really is. You start to drop off physically at that point in time if you haven't already. And it's only the very, very rare ones that are able to continue at a physical level at that point in time. And so he will drop off in a couple of years. And it's, you know, where does it go from there? And he's already missing this season. It makes me sad to think about it. I want to shut up now. Damn it.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't, like, I'm worried right now. I think we've already seen this team waste the primes of some really great players. And I think Watt may just be another one. And again, he just goes to the quarterback situation. They didn't take one for 2 years, pick Brock Osweiler. And this is kind of where they're stuck now. But heading into it, you know, do you have anything else you want to add to Andre Johnson or Arian Foster or, you know, the sadness of time at all?
Getting old sucks. It's good because you're still alive, but, you know, getting old is a tough thing, and you can't quite do things that you want to do. And so whenever, you know, Matt comes to the house and he's still young and strapping and literally fills up most of my living room, you know, I see that, you know, that's, I used to be like that. I used to not always be old and, you know, decrepit and that sort of thing. And it always gets me when it comes to this time of the player's career, you see your favorites, you know, go and you're like, yeah, I know how you feel, dude. So hopefully you young punks will learn about that one day. Get old enough to learn to stop getting old.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of see now as far as, like, getting older, I mean, you know, I'm still in my mid-20s, and people call me a kid, which isn't necessarily true. You know, I'm an adult. But it's just like, I think for me, it's mostly that you have these people that you really care about and these things that you really care about, and then more time occurs and you can no longer spend time with them. People have to go move and do their own things. And also when it comes to sports where you watch these guys for, you know, 12 years, and they're going to grow up and they're not going to be able to do the things that they do anymore. And, you know, they kind of disappear as well too. And so Andre Johnson, the first big one was Michael Young. Andre Johnson was like the next big one. And this one was harder than Michael Young because that was also, like, you know, 5 years ago and that sort of thing. But yeah, this was a rough one. And, you know, you put your earmuffs on, but I fucking love Andre Johnson. I'm gonna fucking miss him. It fucking sucks. And, you know, I wish him all the best for whatever he does in the future. I'm sure he'll be perfectly fine. He's made more than enough money, and it seems like he never had any bad concussions and really, really bad injury aside from some hamstrings. So I'm sure he's just going to be fine, and he's just such a beautiful, great, you know, handsome man who was so good at doing what he did.
Just like me.
Yeah, except your nose may be a little bit wider. And I guess, yeah. So the Texans played a football game in 2013. We watched this game together. So what was your favorite play in this game? Like, if you could go back and pick a highlight, what would it be?
The honest truth is it's probably about a Moses interception of another lame duck from Brock Osweiler. But I won't be a jerk for a change. I'll go with the very, very obvious OPI by C.J. Fedorowicz to get himself open for the touchdown catch, because how that was not called as an OPI just kills me. That was just hilarious. It could not have been more obvious if he tried.
Yeah, I guess mine would have to be the DeAndre Hopkins one-hand catch they had, where he's just running like a simple, you know, drag route, wide open. Brock Osweiler overthrows him. He, you know, his arm detaches from his body, reaches out 7 feet, snags it, and brings it in. And like, really, other than that, like, I guess, you know, it's a Clowney wide nine sack where he beat a backup right tackle, you know, pretty easily. Theo Riddick had a really nice touchdown catch. And that, yeah, that's pretty much it. That's pretty much it. I can't really think of anything else at all.
No, I can't. I really can't either. It was, you know, we're going to hit this theme a couple times, but this is a really boring football team. It just really is. And that's not any sort of, I don't want to come across as being, what's the word I'm really kind of looking for here? It's meant to be completely insulting. It really is. And I don't want to lose back to the side of that. This is not the team that we thought we were getting this year. This really isn't. And I think, once again, it goes back to the absolute hell that is expectations, right? It is that we expected this team to be exciting on offense, up-tempo, Lamar Miller, Braxton Miller, Will Fuller, DeAndre Hopkins. We did not expect to see 85 throws to our tight ends every game. So this season's been all about the bear and the burden of expectation.
Yeah, I mean, it was a really boring game. I think I wrote out an incompletion that it was like sitting in traffic, but less fun than sitting in traffic. And it was, you know, like really, it was just like really boring. Nothing really interesting happened. The only time something almost interesting happens when the Lions score and make it 20-13. And they were down by one possession. They had three timeouts. They had the ball above the 2-minute warning. I think they had 2 minutes and 39 seconds left. And they went ahead and decided to kick to onside kick it. And I know that we hamper on coaches a lot. You know, not just us two, but just in general when it comes to, you know, people with Ryan talk about the game, about them not being aggressive enough, being risk averse. And this is one of those situations where it was being overly aggressive, being stupid. And because, you know, I understand the Lions defense is really bad. You know, they have the worst pass defense in the league. I understand that. But the Texans offense is really bad too. And when they went to kick the onside kick, it's not they were catching Houston off guard. You know, Houston had the hands team. The onside kick was terrible, went straight to the returner. The kicker never really looked set up. It looked like he was trying to hurry it and catch them off guard, even though that they had, like I said, they had their whole hands team there. And the problem I have with it is their defense. You know, they have the worst defense in the league. You're trying to get Matthew Stafford the ball. And so if you kick it, you can give up one first down, maybe two first downs, and Matthew Stafford can still get the ball back because you get to stop the clock four times. Maybe Osweiler throws the incompletion. And then by them doing the onside kick and Houston recovering it, now you're one first down away from Houston being able to kick a field goal to make it two possessions and end it there. And that field goal kick never happened. Instead, Houston was able to just run the clock out. But I really didn't understand it all. I thought it was a very stupid play, and it ended the opportunity for Matthew Stafford to have another one of his wily, you know, fourth quarter comebacks.
Yeah, and I wish there was an explanation for it. And the only thing I can go back to is that Jim Caldwell had lost all confidence in his defense in stopping Alfred Blue from getting 5-6 yards a game. And because they couldn't. I mean, you know, once again, let's go back. The Detroit Lions have a really terrible defense. And they, you know, even the Texans' offensive line, with all its struggles, was able to move the ball. C.J. Fedorowicz was actually blocking like he knew what he was doing. So, you know, I think that was the biggest thing in Caldwell's mind is I'm never going to see the ball again because they're going to run it down the field and run it down my throat. And so I've got to take my chance now. I 100% disagree with that strategy. I do believe in being aggressive. I also believe in taking good risks. And that to me was not a good risk. That was a stupid risk. It should not have been done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, also, like, if you put eight guys in the box too, if you're afraid of that, put Glover Quinn down there. And then it's not like it's a really good run blocking offensive line, and you have Alpha Blue carrying the ball. You know, it's not like you're going against, like David Johnson, the Cardinals, or you're going against the Kansas City Chiefs. Like, this is a team that you can stop the run against. And I just really didn't get it, and it really kind of ruined their game here. But honestly, on the offense, they scored 20 points, and that happened. And they did this mostly on the ground by throwing to tight ends. Does this make you excited off the second half of the season that the Texans scored 20 points this week or entering the bye, coming off a nice win? Are you brighter and happier and rosier and sunnier once they play the Jaguars in Week 10?
I think context. I always think context is just super important. I think it's really important in this case too. We put up 20 points against the worst defense in the league, and that is still not an acceptable number. It really isn't. We need more from this offense. We need more from Bill O'Brien in the scheme. Bill O'Brien was aggressive on a couple of occasions, which was great, exciting and new, and not unlike the Love Boat. But that offense is just going to rely on Alfred Blue and Lamar Miller to hit the hole, and then Brock Osweiler checking down to tight end. That's not an explosive offense. Again, not meeting expectations. So am I excited? Nah. I'm going to be excited to see guys like Jalen Ramsey and Miles Jack and Telvin Smith. Those are fun guys to watch. I miss J.J. Watt. I'm fierce. I want more clowning and wide nine and let him use his speed. Those things excite me. But watching Alfred Blue carry the ball and watching Brock Osweiler throw that ducks all over the field does not excite me. I'm sorry. Just doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, there's something to be said about playing this sort of risk-averse football where you run the ball pretty well, you tackle well, you don't make your mistakes. Like, if you do that and you play good enough defense, you can win football games. Like, Houston's done, they've won five so far, but they haven't played well whatsoever. They haven't been fun to watch. They've been just like had their head above water this entire time, and also their performance does not nearly match their record at all. I think they're a 3-win team according to their expected win total. They won two more games than is what is expected based on the point differential. And they also have a negative point differential too as well. And so it's just like, it's one of those things that, yeah, it's working right now, but when the schedule gets tougher, it does in the second half with games against Oakland, San Diego, Green Bay, and Cincinnati, these wins aren't going to be able to occur. Instead of playing only three good teams in the first half, they're playing four in the second half, and that can change some things as well. This offense performance didn't mean anything to me whatsoever. It was like them scoring in their last three possessions against the Colts to beat them. That was a lot of fun, but it doesn't really indicate any sort of future success at all. And again, like you said, the Lions have the worst defense in the NFL according to DVOA. They're the worst pass defense. And Brock Osweiler was really just like average. I wouldn't even call him average. He was below average again. But the only difference was he only threw one interception, and he was able to hit his tight ends. And these Lions linebackers are the worst linebackers I've seen this year. They can't cover at all. They're slow. They can't come off blocks. And, they took advantage of it by having Ryan Griffin and C.J. Fedoritz do that. But then we've seen have Ryan Griffin and C.J. Fedoritz are against good teams, and they can't do things like this. So, yeah, the context is important here. 20 points against the worst defense in the NFL is nothing to be excited about. There's nothing to be hopeful about going forward. And they should have a much better game than this.
I think so. And let's look at just, if we want to talk about Brock, somewhat transition into that. He completed 69% of his passes for 6 yards per attempt with another pick and an interception. It's good for an 83.4 quarterback rating. So let's put this in perspective. On the season now, Brock has a 73.1 QB rating, which is he's the worst current starting quarterback in the NFL that's not named Ryan Fitzpatrick. At that 83 level, he would not even be in the top 20. So even if that's what he puts up every game, he's still not a top 20, 22 quarterback. So that's the perspective of what he did against the worst pass defense in the NFL. That was missing an all-pro level caliber cornerback in Darius Slay. So there's a lot of problems here. We've got wide receivers not getting separation. We've got Brock, who looks like he has no confidence in him at this UT. No jar change on that one. But you know, the comments by the comments earlier this week about his confidence, but he clearly lacks confidence. You know, wouldn't you? You're setting yourself on fire every time you try to throw the ball. Yeah, I'd lose my confidence too, dadgummit. So he still didn't look confident this week, clearly. I don't know. You know, again, are you excited about the game against the Glitter Kitties? It's just, yes, it's football. I might get my 16. I might get a bonus game this year, 17 games out of the Texans. But this is not, again, expectations not being met.
Yeah, and, I mean, I guess we spent so much time saying bad things about Brock Osweiler. Do you have anything good or nice to say about him at this point? Or after this game or after these first eight games?
He's very tall. He still remains very tall. He's been able to keep that trait with him throughout his struggles this year. He's been able to keep his trait that he is still remains tall. So, you know, sometimes you just got to have the small victories.
Yeah, he is very tall. I like his hair too. His hair is pretty cool. Also, he looks like his dad owns a ski resort in Aspen. So that's cool as well too, but yeah, I don't really have anything good. I like it when he throws the ball deep to Will Fuller, and Will Fuller is able to catch it. That's what I really like, and I like that. But yeah, other than that, I really don't have anything. And then also this game, Alfred Blue had 9 carries for 41 yards. Von Miller had 17 carries for 56 yards. You think Bill O'Brien's finally learned that you should spread running back carries out, 2-1 or something like that, to help keep Lamar Miller fresh, or was Lamar Miller just simply hampered by a shoulder injury?
I don't really care in this case. I'm glad that Lamar Miller was on the bench for a big chunk of the game. I'm glad Alfred Blue was getting a lot of the trash. Not really trash time, but the closeout carried. I was very, very happy to see that. Because we don't need Lamar Miller. We don't need to have the injury report for Lamar Miller's fate, something along the lines of, he'll play until he gets injured too badly to play. That's just stupid. We just invested how many dollars into his career, and our usage of him is, We're gonna keep running him between the tackles, what he does worst of all, until he just, can't play football anymore. So, more Alfred Blue as far as that goes. I was happy to see it, and especially because Alfred Blue, I want to know what happened. Did Alfred Blue and Lamar Miller like swap uniform numbers and nobody they forgot to change the names? I don't get it. But he's running with Wiggle and he's running with Burst. Not great, but enough.
Yeah, I think the difference between the two is I think Lamar Miller is a much better zone back where he likes to use his vision and cut back. And Alfred Blue, I think, is better at just getting the ball running straight forward, just being like a simple straight line compared to Lamar Miller is more of like a doodle. And I think that's why Alfred Blue's had more success this year. And also, he's just looked faster too as well, which is cool. But I still would not go to the point that I would call him a better running back than Lamar Miller or a good running back for that matter. Do you have anything else you want to add to the offense at all?
No, and I just saw the comment about my typing. I don't know what's going on. For some reason, my headset normally doesn't pick it up very much, but evidently it's picking it up now, so I'm doing that on purpose to check it. Okay.
Yeah, I can hear it. In this game, Houston held Detroit to 13 points. That's really good because the Lions have a top 10 passing offense. And this one, the Lions went 3-for-11 on third downs. They held Stafford to an Osweilerian 6 yards an attempt, which is actually probably too high to be Osweilerian. But why were they able to keep Detroit way below their season averages?
That was fascinating. And you and I kind of talked throughout the game about what we were seeing defensively from the Texans. We weren't really getting to the quarterback. I can't remember what the official count was, but I think we just had one official sack on the game, if I remember correctly. Looking, it was Clowney sack. That's the only one. So I think what we saw was we saw some good coverage from the cornerbacks, and we saw even John Simon making plays in coverage. It just, scheme-wise, we weren't really getting to Stafford, but we were getting close to him and doing just enough to throw him off. But really, I think you can really have to point to the coverage and say, man, the coverage just worked. Golden Tate doesn't look like Golden Tate. That's not good. But, I mean, still, A.J. Boye picked up two DPIs. But here's the thing. He picked up two DPIs because he was all over this guy. It's not like he got burned and was grabbing his jersey from behind. I mean, AJ Bouye has made a glue this year. So, you know, even the penalties weren't, like, you know, bad penalties. They, you know, no penalties are really good. But, you know, if you're going to be draped all over a guy and get called for DPI because your arm's wrapped, well, that's a lot better than, you know, pulling the guy down because you got toasted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also if you do that, too, there's a chance that flag may not be called rather than a flag being called for sure. And what I saw was that the Lions weren't really efficient with their offense. Like when they were throwing their quick passes, they were only getting – they're either incomplete or they're getting, you know, 2 or 3 yards rather than like the 7 or 8 they're used to getting. And it just came down to two things. You know, the Texans played really good coverage. And during the season, I talked about how that was going to be the strength of this defense because outside of, you know, Watt entering this year, the front seven really – I guess, you know, Merciless is good too – and Clowney, but the front seven was, you know, top heavy, but not necessarily good at the other spots in the line and at linebacker. And I was talking about the secondary is going to be really important. So, you know, Kareem Jackson played most of the slot. AJ Bouye has been awesome at cornerback number two. Jonathan Joseph's been good as well. Andre Howe doesn't have any interceptions, but he still does enough. And it's also hard to judge him because he's played off the field a lot, but he's just not going to be, he's not going to be deep at all. I mean, I guess Corey Moore exists. They played really good coverage, and they also tackled really well. You know, Golden Tate wasn't breaking tackles. Marvin Jones wasn't breaking tackles. Theo Riddick wasn't breaking a ton of tackles. You know, they kept everything in front of them. They, you know, tackled real well, and they didn't get beat deep at all. And so I think if you're going to play at Lions, that's what you have to do. You have to be able to tackle them. And that is what we were worried about entering this game, too, as well, was that Houston was about 12th or so in tackle and broken tackle rate. And they're like 12th worst in broken tackle rate going this game. And so I was worried about that and also how the Chiefs have played against them, you know, years previous to this one.
Yeah, I think we could just even point to one very specific play. I can't remember the guy who tackled, but it was Kareem Jackson making a tackle in space, in lots of space, that could have been a big gainer. And that just, you know, I love me to come. Some Kareem Jackson when it comes to the tackling. I think that between he and Jonathan Joseph and Kevin Johnson, we easily have the three best tackling corners in, you know, combined in the NFL. I mean, I don't even think it's close, but I think it's easy. They're the three best. But, yeah, it was one of the quick guys. I do think it was Golden Tate, if my memory serves correctly. But he took him down, and it would have been a big game, and it was a fantastic tackle. And that's the sort of thing you've seen all year from guys like Kareem. As a team, they really played it much better, and we're avoiding the misses this week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also, like you said, too, like this wasn't really a pass rush at all. Really, the only pass rush I remember is Clowney as the wide nine, but they weren't consistently even going. Matthew Stafford had plenty of time, and just the coverage was the one that was really sticking around back there. And is this something that you're worried about moving forward, you know, whenever Houston's on the second half of the year against teams like Oakland, San Diego, and Cincinnati, and even with the better Titans team, including, I guess, the Jaguars as well, who don't have any sort of rushing offense. Do you think this pass rush is going to improve at all, or do you think it's going to be, you know, really limited like it has been?
Unfortunately, I think it's going to be limited. We saw a couple of nice rushes from Clowney, as you mentioned, but the rest of the team, they aren't beating guys one-on-one. We have to stunt. We have to blitz in order to get to the quarterback right now. Just the entire, you know, the loss of J.J. Watt means there's one extra blocker or there's one extra guy in a route this year. But Clowney sure as heck wasn't beating the left tackle at all during the game. Whitney Merciless repeatedly was running into brick walls out there. We had some success with A-gap linebacker stunts, but that's what we need to do. That's what was successful for us earlier this year as well. So I wouldn't be surprised to see more of that as we go forward. And I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, really, we got to look at that Clowney wide nine technique that he showed coming off the offensive right side. And he absolutely blew by the backup right tackle that was in. Riley Reiff was out of the game. I can't remember the dude who was playing at the time. But Reiff was out of the game. And Clowney blew right by the guy like he wasn't even there. So I'd like to see more of that. I think you can scheme your way with the athleticism that the Texans have defensively. I think you can scheme your way to more sacks, and I would really like to see Romeo continue to do that.
Yeah, I agree with that, too. I think you can scheme your way. I think the reason why they weren't really blitzing linebackers in this game was because the Lions like to throw passes over the middle. They like to run, like, a lot of crossing routes with Marvin Jones and Ebron and Tate, And rather than have their linebackers blitz and have a big hole in the center of the field, they decided to play a lot more. They had their linebackers sit in the field more often and try to use them to create a pass rush. And it worked very well. I like to see Clowney more wide nine as well. I just like to – I don't know if he's going to be successful or not. And so it's, he's not going against the backup right tackle. Like, I like to see him do that against, Kelvin Beachum in 2 weeks. You know, a player like that, I think, become more interesting. But, yeah.
And yeah, I agree. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. You go ahead.
I was just looking at some numbers too. We talked about one thing that I'd also like to see the Texans do is I'd like to see them get Vince Wilfork off the field more. I know he came out of the game. I don't know if we haven't released injuries yet this week. That'll be tomorrow, but I would like to see C.J. Reeder get more snaps. I would like to see Brandon Dunn off the field. There's no reason to have him out there. Reeder was doing some stuff out there in the defensive line. He was playing pretty well. He's young. That's a position that young guys struggle with a little bit. It takes a couple of years to get the strength for the NFL to play the zero tech that we normally more or less ask of our nose tackle. But Wilfork is still getting way too many snaps out there, and I think that it's really starting to take a toll on his body because he came out of the game with the injury. I would like to see, and I think that Reeder has actually earned those snaps. So, and I'm looking up the snap counts to verify that I'm not completely insane.
And that's what I was going to get too, because Wilfork, I was going to get that as well. That's the last interesting thing I have, was that Wilfork played only 19 snaps against the Jim Bob Cooter defense. That's 31% of the game. And E.J. Reeder played 28 snaps, which is 46% against the Jim Bob Cooter offense. And this happened because Wilfork suffered a non-serious groin injury, is what the internet told me. And also with Wilfork primarily off the field, the Lions got the ball only three times through the middle, and they only got 7 yards. And I think Zach Zenner had two attempts for 0 yards as well. And so Jim Bob Cooter in this offense just couldn't keep things really going up the middle. And I don't know how much of that is just their interior blocking. That's just not something they primarily do. But they weren't able to, and they didn't really go at it at all. And DJ Reed played the majority of the snaps there.
Yeah, I'm taking a quick look. Yeah, Detroit's running game is ranked very poorly by FO, which isn't a surprise in retrospect. Their offensive line wasn't doing anything, and that, let's face it, their running backs are pretty poor too. Abdullah at least is good catching the ball in the backfield. I think nothing of Zach Zenner.
Yeah, well, Theo Riddick is like that as well too. They had like Atlanta Falcons thing going on, and so Abdullah got hurt. And again, like, they're not primarily between the tackles runners. They're getting the ball in space. They're better receivers than they are running backs. And there's the course between them and Atlanta is that Freeman and Coleman are both in between the tackles runners. But they're just kind of like – it's kind of like how I described the Chicago's inside linebackers, Joel Freeman and Trevathan to Carolina. They're just like a lighter version of it. Like the – the Falcons are like Budweiser at running backs, and the Lions are like Natty Light. It's kind of the best way to describe the difference between the two. Do you have anything else to add from this game at all?
Nah, I think I've beaten a dead horse to death. Yeah. Read that.
We talked about so much longer than I wanted to. I'm sure everybody turned this off and everybody's asleep. And yet, if you have a child, put this part of the podcast on talking about, or just put this game on in general, and you'll have a perfect night of just quiet and peacefulness. Let's get to some viewer questions now, though. The first one is from Lawrence Person. He said, if you could trade the best non-J.J. Watt player, somebody like Dwayne Brown, Whitney Merciless, or Clowney, for a quarterback not named Brady, Rodgers, or Roethlisberger, who would you trade and why? And, I would definitely trade Clowney. I would definitely trade Merciless. I would definitely trade Dwayne Brown for a defensive player. I don't know what you do with Osweiler afterwards, but – like, I think it would be entirely worth it if you get a guy like Stafford or, I'm trying to think of the top 10 quarterbacks. And it's really hard, kind of. Or Dalton. Dalton's a top 10 quarterback. But obviously that's, unrealistic. Oh. I can't see any of those teams, making a trade like that.
No. Nobody's going to trade a quarterback for a defensive end. That's not going to happen. This is a quarterback-centric league. you know, Matthew Stafford. Who are they going to, you know, play instead of Matthew Stafford, you know, or the pride of Katie, Andy Dalton? You know, there's no guy. We've had a lot of discussion lately about what is more important or what is the more rare thing in the NFL today. Is it having an offensive coordinator who knows what he's doing, or is it having a quarterback who can actually pull off what the offensive coordinator wants? And I think the answer is pretty obvious. It's having the quarterback who can actually pull off the scheme. There are some offensive coordinators who just do a great job. They can have a revolving wheel of quarterbacks and make them all successful because of their scheme. But having the quarterback is a big deal. And once we get this back to, as we beat another dead horse, we made a decision in 2014 to pick a defensive end over a quarterback. And it's still, 3 years later, a very poor choice that was made. Even if we would have taken Teddy Bridgewater and he would be a good call for him right now. Even if he was Blake Bortles, you know, if Phil O'Brien's your head coach, you'd hope that he would not be Blake Bortles at this stage of his career. So, yeah, that it would be great if something like that were to happen. But even trying to trade for a backup quarterback is not something that's really done in the NFL today. But I would trade Jada Bont, I would trade Clowney. Jadeveon, thank you, I can say it. I would trade Clowney for Cody Kessler. I mean, just to have some hope at the quarterback position.
No, you wouldn't do that. You know, you wouldn't do that. I have a problem with, like, you can't go, like, a potential, like, Pro Bowl player for backup quarterback really well at all. You know, you can do, like, a third-round pick for one, but that sort of thing, but just, like, that production doesn't really match out that well for. And just they're such entirely different positions doing entirely different things. And going back to what you're saying about quarterbacks, I think the best way to look at it is that you get a quarterback who's good, and then you get an offensive coordinator who understands what that quarterback is good at, and they build their offense around it. And then a good example is Derek Carr in Oakland. Derek Carr is really bad against the pass rush. His feet move quickly. He's not able to throw under the rush very well. He doesn't deal with the rush well. So what they do, they put all this money and all these resources into their offensive line while they have them under a cheap contract to keep them upright, and that way he can get better deal in rush behind a really good offensive line from a bad one, and also gives him plenty of time to throw the ball downfield to guys like Crabtree and Cooper, and he's just been phenomenal this year because of it. And I think that really is the key. It's going from, like, building from that player and then going outwards, like you kind of mentioned.
I'm long been a believer that you win games on the offensive and defensive lines anyway. But, you know, the only thing that is above and beyond that is the quarterback position. But, you know, you just explained why Oakland's been successful. Derek Carr's been successful. Why David Carr wasn't successful.
Mm-hmm. Another question from Lawrence Person said, if you have to bet a kidney on the Texans winning one game in November, which would it be and why? And I guess I'd probably bet my left kidney. I don't know. I feel like that's the bad one for whatever reason, because I'm right-handed. But I'm going to have to adapt it, though. You know, that's how it works for, like, your right hand goes with your left kidney, and or goes opposite your left kidney. But it has to be Jacksonville. Jacksonville's been good this year. They have a very good defense, but their offense has been awful because I almost said Osweiler. Because Burrow makes too many mistakes, and they can't run the ball whatsoever. And I believe they play Oakland and San Diego as well in November, and those are, you know, two really good teams.
Yeah, it has to be the divisional games. It has to, because that's our path to the playoffs right now. That's our path to get wiped out in the first round again in the Kansas City fashion. We need to win every game in the division. That way that we can make mistakes and we're out of the division. If that's the path that makes it possible for us. If that's our goal, and that seems to be our goal, is to get to the playoffs, then that's how we do it.
Mm-hmm. And so this question from Upper Root Texan is, if you actually travel through time to the year 23 AD, and the only way you can return is to travel 4,000 miles, get limits to make a battery to fix your time machine, do you make the trip or decide to make a new life in the classical era? Also, this happened, could this make Brock Osweiler a better quarterback? And I think the thing about it here is that if it's 23 AD, I'm probably going to die pretty fast anyways, all these different diseases. And I'll probably actually just kill everybody because I'll have all these diseases they're not used to. And I would definitely want to come back home because it would just be just too strange and too overwhelming to go that back far in time. And Yeah, there's the only way I think Brock Osweiler would be good is if I found the patriarch that he came from and taught that man how to throw a football. So then somehow that was able to be passed down year after year after year after generation after generation. And then not teach him like how to throw a ball, but like how to place the ball somewhere, you know? And I think if I could do that, he may be good. And that's a really big if there.
I love that, yeah. No, the 23 AD, no thank you. You know, what is the life expectancy of a person in 23 AD? I could easily walk 4,000 miles. I got no worries doing that.
Yeah, I think
and
it's like
still,
35
no.
or so. Like you, I think
yeah,
it's like 35 years old.
And yeah, I mean, you're going to be eaten by, you're going to be eaten by dinosaurs, right?
Yeah. The other question from UT is, do you think Brock Osweiler throws an interception this week? And I mean, I think he definitely like goes to throw something away in a trash can to shoot it, and somebody's definitely going to just snatch up the air and throw it right back in his face. So I think he's going to throw at least one, or he's going to probably throw seven in practice, but he's going to throw an interception this week.
Oh, yeah, I don't see how they're even just going to add an interception to his total just because, you should. So.
and he's throwing
it anyway.
To DeAndre Hopkins, too.
Right, of course.
I think he's thrown six now because he threw that one this week, and he just throws it right behind him, giving the defensive back a chance to make a play of the ball and he shouldn't be able to. And he was open also, but I think he's thrown six now. And I think Oswald's thrown seven interceptions this year, too.
Wow, yeah, We didn't really touch on the interception this week, but that was a duck. It was a dead duck. It was an aim. It had nothing on it. Threw it sort of good 4 or 5 yards behind Dante. I mean, it was like he was throwing a back shoulder pass, but the guy was DeAndre was in front of the guy. So it's kind of like even the long pass to throw in that situation. That
mm-hmm.
was a really bad pick. That was really bad.
So we're at the halfway mark of the season, and so now we're going to start checking on playoff standings from now until the year's over. I'm going to go by Football Outsiders. They have the best playoff odds out there. They run like 10,000 different simulations. It's based off DVOA and also preseason expectations, kind of get weaned out over time as well, too. And they usually do a pretty good job with it. So right now, Houston's 5-3. Tennessee is 4-4. The Colts are 3-5. Jacksonville's 2-6. When you look at mean wins, Houston's at 7.9. Tennessee's at 7.7, Indy's at 6.5, Jacksonville's at 5.8, and the probability to make the division, Houston right now is leading at 44.5%. It jumped 10.9% after this win. Tennessee's at 31.3%. It jumped 7.9% after being Jacksonville. The Colts are at 13.3%, and the Jags are at 10.9%. I think my favorite things about these odds is like the Jaguars have a 10.9% chance to win the division, but 11.3% chance to win the playoffs. And if you look at Houston, they have a 44.5% chance in the division and just a 45.9% probability to win the to make the playoffs. So there's going to be one team out of the playoffs in this division, and whoever wins this division is going to get in. And I think that's kind of like the key thing here. But, like, are you nervous about Tennessee right now? Has your opinion kind of changed, or are you just kind of stuck on the fact that the Texans are going to win this division no matter what?
I think that the game on January 1st at – Bethania. I think that's our entire season. I really do right now. That is going to be the must-win game of the year for the Texans. The fact is that Tennessee has done a better job about putting their guys, I say it all the time, putting that team in a situation to compete and succeed. I think they're doing a far better job. The defense is still not good, but it's good enough. The stupid, moronic, exotic smash mouth. It's still stupid and moronic, but you know what? They're having success with it. And Marcus Mariota is doing enough damage to the air to offset some of the stupidity. He's got a 4-6 touchdown and interception ratio. He's got a 95.1 QB rating. He's added another over 200 yards on the ground. This is the only team in the division that can say this, is that it's average on both sides of the ball, right? No other team in the AFC South can say they are average on both sides of the ball. wanted to, to verify that. So Tennessee is now ninth in offense by DVOA. The Texans, of course, are dead last. Jacksonville's 28th. Indianapolis is 15th. So we're not exactly an offensive powerhouse division, but you already knew that. Defensively, they are 22nd. Whereas Jacksonville is, where the hell is Jacksonville? There is 18th. Houston is, of course, the best in division, 12th, and Indianapolis is 85th in the league. So they're the only team, the BESF, the only team in the division that can say, hey, we're pretty average on both sides of the ball. The Texans sure can't say that. Jacksonville sure can't say that. And I think that ultimately what that means is this is going to be a struggle, and that's going to be the game. If we lose one of these games to Jacksonville, especially January 1st, that's the season.
Yeah, I think that's what their design season is going to come down to. Is they're going to have to stay, they're going to have to be tied with Houston entering week 17, and so they're going to need to hope that Houston either wins zero games against San Diego, Oakland, Green Bay, and Cincinnati, which will probably happen if you just go by performance, or they hope that they lose a game to Tennessee or they lose a game to Jacksonville or Indianapolis while they're able to sweep their division, win their easy games. And so, yeah, I agree. I think it's going to come down to week 17 too. Kind of like how the NFC East in years before, you would look at who were the Cowboys playing week 17 and then just pick that team to win the division, because that's how it went for like 3 years in a row. And I think it's just kind of a similar situation here. But then other times also is like, so the Texans are 5-3, but they're not a 5-win team, like based on their performance. The Titans are actually playing good football, but their performance is there. It's not that they're winning, you know, cheap games or getting lucky at the end or that sort of thing. They're actually winning games and they're playing pretty well. And so I think this division is far from over. And I think Tennessee has been the better football team this year too as well. And I also love that I like every time I check DVOA, I'm always kind of hoping for Houston to be 32nd. Because it's just the funniest thing to me, after putting all these resources and all this effort and building all this hype up for the season, that they've gone to 32nd in DVOA on offense. It's just so unbelievable. Like, it's so unbelievable.
I wanted to add just one question that I wanted to talk about during the show tonight. So, we see how bad Brock Osweiler's been. We see how bad the offensive line plays. Who, when you look at the Texans being so poor offensively, who's that on? Is that on Bob, Brock, Rick Smith? What do you think?
I say Osweiler still, because I know O'Brien can do things to, you know, make the offense work a little bit better. Because I think so much of it, he's just trying to get by and trying to scrape by with his play calling and the way they're game planning. So I think this really has limits to this offense as well. But, I mean, I think a lot of it just comes down to Osweiler. Like, they run an offense where accuracy is really important, and he just doesn't have the accuracy. And then also just, like, the way he's reacted to pressure has been so bad, how risk-averse he's been where he's not taking shots downfield even when they're open, has just been so bad. And also, like, last year, that's the biggest difference between on this offense. It's not that – They got worse on the offensive line. But I think the biggest difference is the quarterback change, and that was a big thing heading this year. And you kind of have to attribute that to Osweiler for the reason why the offense is bad.
Yeah, and I'm going to say Bill O'Brien because I'm going to say whoever decided it was that Brock Osweiler was the guy, because that was kind of a thing that I really ranted about in my Fisking, was that, you know, we know, or at least Bill O'Brien has told us what he expects and wants at the quarterback position, and that there is no way in Hades that Brock Osweiler can actually do the thing that Bill O'Brien supposedly wants from a quarterback. It's all about mechanics and solid, repeatable mechanics, coming over the shoulder, throwing over the knee, following through, directing the, you know, putting your energy towards the spot that you want the ball. And it's like, just like a classic pitcher, right? Because that's what you're doing. Mm-hmm. It's a pitching motion. That's why baseball players throw footballs around to help improve their arm strength. So that's what Bill O'Brien said he wanted. And then you look at Brock Osweiler's throwing motion and you see a guy who's shot putting from the shoulder. These aren't impressive mechanics. He does not have good arm strength. He might when he comes over the top, but he just doesn't do it. So, you know, I'm going to say whoever, and I feel like that was Bill O'Brien's call to hitch his horse to that particular, or that his wagon to that particular horse, because he has to be the one to ultimately make the call on that. If Rick Smith told him, hey, we're not going to draft you a quarterback in the first round, we're not going to trade up, I think that's something else completely different. If Uncle Bob said, hey, there's no way we're going to draft Carson Wentz or anybody else, or should I say, the dude in Denver, dadgummit, I forgot his name, the quarterback there, or we're not going to draft Christian Hackenberg, we're not going to draft this guy. Paxton Lynch, thank you. If that's what Bob or Rick Smith is saying and it was forced into Bob's hand, then that's one thing. But if it's another thing that Bill O'Brien actually watched tape on the guy and said, oh, he's perfect for me. And so the other factor here is that you're still kind of doing the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and getting the same results. And that's what I see with the Texans offense right now. Yes, we mix things up a little bit differently. I get it. But it just took playing a cover two man scheme to shut our offense down completely. Everything away from it. I mean, if it's that simple, then Bill O'Brien has done a very poor job as a head coach and the quote unquote offensive coordinator for this team.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the fact that cover two has completely stopped everything is hilarious. And I do think Brock Osweiler is Bill O'Brien's quarterback because the guys he's chosen have been. You know, tall guys, strong arms, you know, Tom Savage, Ryan Mallett, you know, Brock Osweiler. Those are the type of guys I think he likes. I think he chose Hoyer and Fitzpatrick because they're smart. And then in Hoyer's case, he played for New England. He knows his system, you know, and if your system's that complicated, you probably shouldn't coach a system like that. But I think the problem, we talked about this before, I wrote about this so much, was that they didn't take a quarterback in 13. There's three starting quarterbacks from that second round. They took a guard. I mean, I guess Garoppolo's going to be a starting quarterback next year, probably. They took a guard instead who's been, you know, very, very average. And that's kind of been the difference. Like, that was the year for them to take somebody. That was the year they had the draft capital to do so, and they didn't. And so now you're kind of seeing all the repercussions from that. And last year, I don't think Osweiler was – I don't know if Osweiler was taken necessarily because they watched the film and said, we have to have this guy. I think they watched the film and said, we can probably do something with this, and we need to have a guy. And I think that's what led to him being there in Houston. But I'd really like to know what the thought process was behind the draft. And I guess it was 14. I always say 13 because I'm stupid. But the thought process in 14, how much of an input, like, it works between Rick Smith and Bill O'Brien when it comes to these quarterback decisions? If it is mostly O'Brien, or, you know, how they go about that? And also just, like, why O'Brien values things like arm strength and size so much more than ball placement and pocket presence and touch and you feel the pocket and all these sorts of things that, you know, you're more innate that you can't necessarily teach, you know?
Right. And which goes back to the video of him talking about how important ball placement and accuracy are. And that's why it's completely goes against what he said. And that's why I put this really on Bob more than I do anybody else, is because at some point you have to believe your own BS and you have to go with that. You can't keep preaching about, I mean, if I'm running a team and I've been preaching about offensive line and defensive line play for the past however many years I've done a podcast, six or seven, if I've been preaching about this for so many years and I've become GM of a team and all of a sudden I'm drafting wide receivers and running backs, I'm ignoring my line, then that's just, I don't believe my own BS. And that's what I'm getting from Bill O'Brien right now, is he had a strategy. He had one that was logical and made sense before he became an NFL head coach. And evidently, that's all been thrown out once he became a coach in the NFL. He doesn't believe it. He's going to go draft the Will Fullers instead of drafting the defensive line. He's going to draft Braxton Miller instead of drafting offensive line. Look, I get it. You need to have weapons. I get it. But it doesn't matter if you're putting a turbocharger on your car when the thing is falling apart as it exits the driveway. So there's a lot of disconnect here between Bill O'Brien and what he said in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, none of the quarterbacks he's taken, you could say, and also the quarterbacks he's selected, you not only can point to that, you can say he's very accurate or he has good ball placement. I'm not a single one of them at all, and I think it's also frustrating. And I also think kind of that one of the problems too, this Osweiler decision as well. I know I talked about it a lot in the draft when we did our draft podcast, is that they didn't take a quarterback at all like the third or fourth round, and so with Osweiler, you don't know if it's going to work out for sure. You can get out of this deal after 2 years. So why not take a guy in the middle of the draft, teach him, train him, you know, housebreak him for 2 years. Then that way, if Oswald doesn't work out, you can get rid of him. You can bring in young quarterback who knows your offense now because it's so hard to do, who you've trained, who you've molded, and that way you can get out of Oswald and have a succession plan from there. And instead now, if like Oswald doesn't work out, you're looking at some hypothetical future that's completely unknown. Or, you know, Tom Savage is going to be a free agent that time too. And instead, you have Bram Weeden as your third string quarterback and Tyler Irvin. And I think that was a huge miss, a huge mistake. And I'm not even saying like, oh, I was all about Dak Prescott in the draft. Look how good he is. I'm saying that just take one of the guys. Take Prescott. I know Hackenberg was gone. Take Kessler. Take Hogan. Take Connor Cook. Take anybody that you can teach and groom and then hope whenever it comes to the time in 2 years it doesn't work out. You can do something. At the worst, you have a good backup quarterback or a trade chip in the future.
Yeah, the only real problem with that is that the idea of the developed quarterback like that, you take the guy in the fourth, fifth round, that is not thrust into starting. Speaking very specifically about Dak Prescott, is that it's kind of a fallacy. It doesn't really happen. So it's quarterbacks either get the opportunity to go show it on the field. Most of the time that's done by injury. And I'm thinking the best case of that is sixth round Tom Brady going in for Drew Bledsoe for the Patriots many years ago. And then Brady just won, you know, outplayed Bledsoe, and Bledsoe said, hey, you know what, he's outplaying me. And that's it. That was the Tom Brady era beginning. But you don't often have a guy who's taken the third, fourth round who develops over the course of a couple of years and then is all of a sudden behind somebody, and then he gets thrust up in the starting spot and is a good quarterback. It's mostly an injury. Because I cannot think of a single guy. I think Brock Osweiler is a case for the anti against this because he was a guy drafted in the second round. He was drafted to be groomed for the starting quarterback job, and he couldn't win it over Peyton Manning and his 8-75 touchdown interception ratio last year.
Well, I mean, I think the setting doesn't really matter. You know, like whether he got injured or not, Brady still learned for 2 years. You're still talking about, I guess you can talk about, you know, Kurt Warner, even like he still learned, I guess, before that guy got injured. So I guess like it doesn't really necessarily matter the situation. Like they could have took Prescott, Oswald could have gotten injured or benched after 10 weeks. And then it's not necessarily that he learned for 2 years and that's what made him good, but he's kind of good to begin with. But it's just the fact that you don't have a plan at all whatsoever in case this doesn't work out. And yeah, I mean, the majority of times, third round quarterbacks, fourth round quarterbacks aren't good. The majority of the time, they aren't. Most of the quarterbacks who are very good are taken earlier in the draft. But like, you still have the opportunity to do something to kind of set yourself up for the future. And they didn't do it.
Yeah. You're not wrong. There should have at least been some strategy there, something, instead of the nothing burger that we got. And let's be honest, this has been going on since 2012, right? Yeah, since 2012, since the 2012 offseason when NBC and I had a conversation, do we have to go get a quarterback because Matt Schaub does not look right? And we both said yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think even 11, after he had the foot injury, I think even then was the time to say, well, you know, this is a bad injury. He's this age. You know, quarterbacks who are above average tend to fall off a lot faster than quarterbacks who are, you know, great. They have less to hold on to when it comes to the wedge. And so I think even then, sooner was probably a better time to do that. And yeah, and that's kind of where this problem stems from. And it's just been slowly being a problem more and more and more from there.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the plan is for – I mean, that's pretty much all we got. I think that was kind of sitting in the back of the dorm room at 2 o'clock a.m. sort of talk, but that was a good conversation. And so this week the Texans do have the bye. They're off for the week. Yeah, I'm sure they're going to be having lots of fun. And so for next week's show, we're going to dive into numbers a bit, do kind of like a breakdown of all that. I'm going to write a post this weekend on that. And we're handing out some midseason awards. And at the end, we're going to preview their game against Jacksonville, which is in Jacksonville. You know, me, Al. So how does that sound to you, BFD?
That sounds awesome.
Yeah. Well, thanks for listening to everyone, and thanks to everyone who asked questions for us tonight, too. If you enjoy the show, tell all of your friends. And if you listen to us on iTunes, go ahead and rate and review the show as well. We will be back next week at the same time, Tuesday, 7 p.m. Central, where again we'll handle some awards, look at some numbers, and preview the Jaguars game and all that stuff. So, yeah, I'm Matt Weston. Thanks for listening to Valve Red Radio, and thanks for being on tonight, BFG.
I thought it was pretty good.